to the committee.
Vice Chair Burdick, Senator Starr, Council. For the record, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. My current work responsibilities include the supervision and administration of the termination of parental rights caseload and providing general assistance and advice to our attorneys and to assistant district attorneys throughout the state in juvenile law, delinquency, and dependency cases. Senate Bill 115 is an amendment to the shelter care provision of the Dependency Code, which is intended to clarify what is the current practice in most juvenile courts in the state with respect to the admission of hearsay evidence in these proceedings. I think with just a little bit of background, that statement or that intent will be clear. When a child in Oregon is taken into protective custody because his conditions and circumstances appear to endanger his welfare, unless the child is returned to the parent immediately, the juvenile court has to hold a hearing in the child's case within 24 hours. And at that time, usually a petition is filed stating why the juvenile court should be involved in the case. And at the shelter hearing, which is that 24-hour hearing, the state presents its evidence as to why the child may need to be in shelter care or a foster home pending the adjudication of the petition. In other words, what do we need to do to make the child safe during the period of time it takes to get the case before the juvenile court for a hearing? Now, for many years, all of the juvenile courts in the state have applied a standard in those proceedings which acknowledged the rapid time that they had to present the case, in other words, within 24 hours. And that means in many cases that medical professionals who have examined the child, police officers who investigate the situation, aren't always able to be present as witnesses. And for that reason, the opinions of medical doctors, the observations of police officers and other citizens are presented as hearsay evidence by caseworkers and other folks. Now, in recent years, the juvenile court in Linn County and perhaps one or two other counties have been strictly applying the rules of evidence in these cases to exclude this hearsay evidence, with the result that children's safety is endangered because of the delay in having to get those people to a hearing in person, and also expense to the state as far as indigent defense and court costs are concerned. And what this bill does, again, is to clarify that hearsay evidence is not to be excluded from these preliminary hearings. Now, in these hearings, the parents have the right by statute to subpoena witnesses and to present any evidence that they have to say that it's safe to return the child to the home. By excluding the evidence as hearsay of doctor's reports, police reports, and other reports, basically the child is sent home in many cases to a dangerous situation. And if I may, I have a number of examples, but I think the one I have from just this last month is probably the most telling. On January the 8th, a 14-month-old child was seen at Dornbecker Hospital in Portland. He had been referred up there from Albany Hospital for a detailed cranial x-ray for what appeared to be a skull fracture. The doctor who examined the child at Dornbecker after reading the x-rays reported to DHS, the Child Protective Services Agency, pursuant to the Child Abuse Reporting Act, that the child appeared to have a non-accidental skull fracture and also appeared to have a fracture of the left femur. This is a 14-month-old child. And those two fractures, plus the parent's delay in seeking medical attention, meant to that doctor that it was possible abuse. And also there appeared to be no reasonable explanation for the injury. 2 weeks later, a follow-up x-ray of the femur was done and confirmed that it was a twisting-type fracture. So the child was taken into protective custody, and 24 hours later, pursuant to the statute, a shelter care hearing was held. At the hearing, the caseworker testified to what she had been told by the doctor and by the medical social worker at Dornbecker. However, because according to the judge, that evidence was hearsay, which means the doctor was not there to give that testimony, the judge denied the request for shelter care and sent the child home. While the child was at home, he sustained another fracture. And the agency again took the child into protective custody and 24 hours later set another hearing, this time providing not only the caseworker's testimony, but also the testimony of a child abuse physician, who's an expert in child abuse, who had reviewed all of the medical evidence that the doctors had provided, the x-rays, and concluded that the injuries appeared to be non-accidental, that is, the result of abuse, and the parents had no explanation. At the end of that hearing, and by the way, the attorneys and the parents had also been provided with all of the medical records, at the end of that hearing, the court again denied shelter care because the evidence was hearsay, according to the judge. Now, this practice is apparently unique to Linn County and just a couple of other counties when a pro tem judge who follows this practice appears in those other counties. And in a way, it's a little bit redundant to have to write into statute what is the current practice in most courts. I've talked with Judge Terry Leggett, a Marion County Juvenile Court judge, on Friday. I was trying to see if she could come to today's hearing because we had just learned of the schedule at the end of last week. She says that she is not available to come today, but to pass along to the committee that she's absolutely in support of this clarification in the law and confirms that there is absolutely no way that in most of these cases it's possible to get live witnesses within 24 hours to come to one of these hearings. I should also add that at one of these 24-hour hearings, if the court orders the child to go home into shelter care, the parents can seek a hearing within 2 or 3 days after that to review that decision. So this is not a permanent decision to send the child in foster care. It's just a decision by the court at this particular time that pending adjudication of the petition, the child's safety requires that he or she be placed in shelter care. And I think this, the example that I just gave, is probably the best example of both the risk to the child and also the expense that the state, both indigent defense, the court system, and the Attorney General's office and the VAs have to bear when this practice is in place. You know, there have been two hearings already in this case at substantial expense to the lawyers and the court, and a third now must be held. And the dilemma that we're in, and the reason that we're here asking you to enact this legislation, is that we can't appeal these rulings because they're what are called interlocutory rulings. They're preliminary rulings that can't be appealed. And frankly, even if they could be appealed, by the time the court heard it, the damage has already been done.
Thank you. Before we proceed, I'd like to convene a full committee meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee, since we now have a quorum. So I can proceed.
Can I say something? Right? Mr. Livingston, I wanted to interrupt. Thank you, Vice Chairperson Burdick. Senators that arrived a little bit late, we're taking testimony on Senate Bill 115, which is a bill that relates to dependency cases. It's a bill that particularly relates to shelter hearings in dependency cases where a child is taken into the custody of the state. And the bill would, Michael Livingston here is here from the AG's office, he's told us that basically would codify what is already the current practice in most counties, which would be to allow hearsay evidence into this initial shelter hearing.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question, please? I'm looking at the bill where it says the court shall receive testimony, et cetera, without regard to its competency or relevancy under the rules of evidence. And I'm very familiar with the definition of relevancy, but competency is one of those words that goes back to law school that nobody uses anymore. And I'm wondering why, what is competency, and why is that the best way to get at what you're doing?
Chairman, Vice Chair Burdick, and Senator Ringo, competency refers to hearsay. It's the term of art for hearsay, and the reason this particular language is used is because it already is the standard for the admission of evidence in other disposition hearings in the juvenile code. It just seemed to be a simple transfer of an existing standard into this section. I should add, and it's the last paragraph on my written testimony, that since this amendment was submitted, especially during last week, I've had conversations with other interested parties, the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland, which is a consortium of attorneys who represent children in these cases, and also members of our own human resources attorneys in the General Counsel Office, who have a concern that this standard, as you've identified, may not go far enough. In other words, it may be read more narrowly than what the current practice is, and what the proposal would be just to simply come out and say it flatly that as in criminal preliminary hearings, that hearsay is just admissible.
Is the word competency defined in the evidence code? I don't believe it is.
No. No, that would be another reason to clarify and just make it hearsay.
Yeah, I would like comments from committee counsel, but I just don't you think it would be cleaner just to say create an exception for the evidence from the hearsay rule?
Vice Chair, Woman Burdick and Senator Ringo, I do think we could, if Mr. Livingston wants to, we could make it as. Try to clarify. I see Mr. Travis, who is an excellent drafter, shaking his head, so I don't know what that
is. That
means.
Shaking his head no or yes? No? Okay, well, I'll wait to hear from him then. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I do think that it would be clearer, and again, the reason that this particular language was chosen in the initial amendment was because it's already in the code and has a construction and an application through existing statute.
I mean, to me, we're perpetuating language that doesn't make sense. I mean, and I'll be interested in hearing the other's argument. I mean, for one thing, do we really want to, let's look at relevancy. I can't imagine why we would want to say, regardless of relevancy, if it's not relevant, we should keep it out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I certainly agree with you. Just reading it textually, I think the reason for allowing evidence without regard to relevancy is a pretty narrow one, and that is to be relevant, it has to tend to prove or disprove a fact and issue. And at the dispositional phases of these proceedings, it's very difficult to identify the facts that are at issue, because really the court is dealing with a totality of circumstances. And I think it's not so much to say that evidence can come in even if it has nothing to do with the case. It's just to say that you can't keep out evidence just because you can't point to a specific issue that's subject to proof in the case.
I'm gonna want to hear more from the drafter. That doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Travis, if you can help us out.
Timothy Travis, the Oregon Judicial Department. The reason that I would not, you're right, Senator Lindor, you're absolutely right, and it should be that way. I would not want it to be that way in this particular statute, because this language appears in other places in the juvenile code. And if we use different language here to mean the same thing that we mean by other language in another place in the juvenile code, some lawyer is going to say, this language is different than this language. It must mean something different. Therefore, da-da-da-da-da. I would love, Senator Ringo, one of my life's works is rewriting the juvenile code to get rid of this exact kind of language. I would love to have it read exactly what you wanted to read in terms of the hearsay rule, if we can change it everywhere else at the same time, so that we don't have two different sets of words trying to say the same thing. And that's my only objection to doing it that way at this point.
I mean, are there other places in the juvenile code where it says evidence can be allowed even though it's not relevant?
It says exactly this language in the dispositional statute 419B326. The other piece of this that's kind of confusing to practitioners in the field and to judges as well is that this language is strictly limited to evidence about the child. And in most courts, in most places where you go, people read this to be evidence about anybody. And so at some preliminary, as Mr. Livingston says, in a criminal preliminary hearing, you can have all kinds of evidence come in on hearsay about anybody or anything. But not according to the law in a juvenile proceeding. It's supposed to be limited to that stuff about the kid. It's not supposed to be hearsay stuff about the parents. And so we may want to look at cleaning that up as well, because this language is more limited, I think, than people think it is. Your relating clause says allows hearsay at shelter hearings, I believe. I don't have the bill in front of me.
Relating to shelter hearings.
Yeah, but it's not that wide. It's really more narrow. It only has to do with the child.
Is the word competency defined anywhere?
No, it isn't, Senator.
So are you, just to pursue this a little bit, do you share the concern that it might inadvertently narrow the type of evidence that's able to be presented?
Senator Burry, I think that people have their grasp of what this language means in other places in the code. And I think they will bring that grasp to shelter hearings if that same language appears there. My concern is that if different language appears in two different places, you know how lawyers are.
Yes.
Can I, if I can add something? I think there are two basic questions here. Number one is, do we need to do something? And I hope that the example that I gave, the general example and then the specific example, shows the need for that. Regrettably, we wouldn't have to do that if we didn't have one or two courts kind of going off in this different direction. And I should add, too, that this is not a slam at the court. It's just a view that they are wrong and it's detrimental to the children. The second question is, how do we fix it? And I really think that again, if we have a few days to sit down and get the folks together, that we can come up with language that, number one, doesn't inadvertently narrow what we're trying to do, and number two, perhaps address Senator Ringo's concern about the sloppy language, which is. And I would ask the committee to, I guess, allow that or to bear with us on that, and then to hear this again soon.
Okay, well, maybe you could work with Senator Ringo on that effort.
Madam Chair, far be it from me to rewrite the juvenile code. I've never even read it before, and I don't want to read it now. it just bothers me that we're putting terms in that we know are undefined. Relevancy is very, very much defined, but we're saying you put evidence. You cannot have evidence admitted that is irrelevant. Blows me away. I don't want to be involved in rewriting the juvenile code. Thank you.
Okay. I think Senator Ringo just withdrew himself. So
yeah.
Are there other questions from the committee? Comments? Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 115. Turn the gavel over to the leader of the PAC.
The late leader of the PAC.
Kelly Taylor.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. We asked that this bill be introduced. It's something that it's a statute that's been growing and growing through the years. It's a housekeeping bill. It's taking a section of law that has most of the suspension revocation statutes in it. It's grown to 39 subsections. It's become quite unwieldy whenever there's a bill being introduced that either changes existing suspension revocations or adds a new one. It's become unwieldy for ledge counsel. It makes the bills quite long because you're trying to encompass all of that, even though you're just touching a tiny little piece somewhere. And it makes implementing legislation a little more cumbersome, too, because if you change something in the middle of subsection 13 and renumber everything, all of the different forms, suspension notices, et cetera, that cite all the different subsections have to then be changed, too. So what this bill is simply doing is taking those 39 subsections of suspension revocation language and breaking them up into smaller, more manageable statutes in alike types, those revocations related to conviction of crime, suspensions related to conviction, accident related, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a housekeeping bill. There are no substantive changes, but it should make life a little easier for legislative counsel and certainly for us, too, along the way, both in day-to-day life, trying to find something in statute book, and also when considering future legislation. That's it in a nutshell, and I would ask the committee to support the bill.
So, Kelly, who worked on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Joan Robinson was the legislative counsel that drafted the bill.
Did you bring it to her?
Yes, we did. We had asked the governor to introduce it on our behalf, and we worked with her quite extensively on this bill.
All right. And are there any substantive changes in it?
No, Mr. Chair, not at all.
All right. So we're merely reorganizing existing statute.
Mr. Chair, that's right. Streamlining some of the, you know, how each subsector would have its own little piece about whether it's administrative hearing or contested case hearing. All those subsections carried all of that. And so each group now has some instructions at the front and then what the suspensions are in them. So, but there's no substantive changes. It's just cleaning up of existing language.
All right. And, how long ago did you request this bill?
Mr. Chair, we have to have our request in by April of the previous year, and then she worked on it last summer through fall.
All right. Any committee members have questions regarding the bill? Okay. All right. Well, we'll do a little work session. Senator 245.
Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I think we adopt Senate Bill 245 and send it to the Senate floor on the when it do pass recommendation on the consent calendar.
Senator Brady moves the adoption of Senate Bill 245 to report the Senate do pass recommendation and including it in consent calendars. Any discussion? Any objections? There are none. Senator Brady will be the official carrier of this final piece of legislation. The last piece of legislation we're waiting for the proponent. Are myself and primarily Senator Metzger. Metzger's not available until 9 o'clock, so we'll be in recess until 9. Thank you.
Recess till 9?
I'll call the committee back to order. Senate Bill 348, public hearing. Senator Metzger, do you know what this bill does that I signed on to?
You're in sign in, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good to see all your smiling faces this morning.
It's funny.
Senate Bill 348 continues a policy trend that we have had in the legislature in terms of putting an enhanced prerequisite in protecting children. This expands the crime of recklessly endangering another person to include driving a motor vehicle under the influence of intoxicants when a child is a passenger in the vehicle. More than 12,000 children under the age of 14 have died in alcohol-related traffic accidents between 1994 and 2000, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And in 64% of those deaths, the child was riding with the drunk driver. While traffic fatalities involving alcohol have declined 25% since 1990, the percentage of child passenger deaths has not decreased significantly. According to a recent study from the University of North Carolina, the percentage of alcohol involvement for child fatalities has actually increased. The study has noted that drunk drivers who had children in the vehicle at the time of their offenses were more likely to have previous drunk driving convictions or prior driver's license suspensions and were less likely to buckle up their children. Senate Bill 348 enhances the penalty for those driving under the influence of intoxicants when there is a passenger in the motor vehicle who is under 18 years of age. Mr. Chair, I, in some of the material that was passed out to you, you have a letter of support from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and also just a very recent sad news clipping from just a week ago in which another young person, and this one happened to be in my district, who was killed as a passenger, as a minor, riding in the vehicle of an individual who had been drinking. And I think it's in 1999 we passed enhanced driving responsibility requirements for young people simply to get a license. I think, again, recognizing how important protection of minors are. In some of our other laws, Mr. Chair, that we worked on last session in this very same committee in terms of enhancing penalties for those who have meth labs and unsafe homes, also enhancing penalties for those offenses when children were present. And I think this is a likely extension of that and also continues a trend nationally in which recognizing that while this is a bad offense in any case, driving under the influence, but recklessly endangering a young person as a passenger in doing so should be recognized with enhanced penalties. Mr. Chair, that is my testimony.
Thank you very much, Senator Metzger. Thank you for allowing me to sign on to this marvelous piece of legislation. Senator Metzger, well, let's see, Senator Burdick, you don't look at all like
Senator Metzger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although we've been walking together, so that may seem to change. Senator Metzger, the bill has a provision that the enhanced penalties don't apply if the person operating the motor vehicle is less than 12 months older than the youngest passenger in the motor vehicle. So this incident that happened in your district, as I read it, would not have been affected.
It depends. It could have or may not, Senator. We don't know the month of the individual involved. In this case, it was 18 and 17, so we don't know if they were almost 19 and the other one was, you know, just turned 17. Potentially, right, that could have been either way depending on the month of birth.
How did you settle on, if I can follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, of course.
How did you settle on 12 months as a reasonable time age gap?
Yeah, that's a good question, Senator, and there is no you know, magic formula for determining that. What we did was look at, through some research with the National Council of State Legislatures, and looked at other states, which are numerous, for enhanced penalties with carrying, you know, minor children. And they run the gamut. Some have no differentiation. Some have 3 or 4 years. Some have a year. So to be totally candid, we looked at some of the states that were more in the norm, recognizing that most are able to get a driver's license at the age of 16, and looked at you know, those who were riding basically as teen companions, trying to try to recognize those differently than an adult who may be riding with a minor child. So we have no magic formula for that. I mean, certainly we have considered different age groups, but we basically looked at the norm that we found with other state rules that use the year or 2 year parameter.
Senator Metzger, I assume the objective in the bill is to try to prevent persons under 18 being in cars with individuals who are intoxicated. Is it focusing mostly on adult drivers?
Yes, Senator. I think the objective is that when you become of age at the age of 18, that you have an enhanced responsibility for those who you would carry, and that is to recognize that.
Right. Good. Other questions?
Just a comment.
Senator Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, I read about this in the State Legislature magazine for National Conference of State Legislatures, mm-hmm. and was going to introduce the same bill, but found out there were lots of others who were doing it. So I assume you're one of those lots of others and wouldn't mind if I signed on to your bill.
Okay, certainly.
All right. Council, you suggested that there may be a way of making this bill a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was just wanted to point out that this has been put in recklessly endangering, as Senator Metzger knows. By my reading of this of the bill, it would not require a reckless state of mind to prove this crime. If you look at the new language, I think the court would read it that a person drives a motor vehicle under the influence of intoxicants and there's a passenger who's under 18 years of age. That's all that would need to be proven. There would then be a construction of this. If a statute does not specifically say what state of mind is to be applied, in a case like this, I think they would look at that. They then go to their rules of construction that say that you have to find a culpable mental state, and that would, I think, go to as low as criminal negligence in this case. So I think Ms. Skye is probably going to address that too. And I was one thing that could be done would be to just put an enhancement penalty in the DUII statute, which does not require a state of mind. And then you could enhance the penalty, for example, which is basically what is being done here, is my reading, enhancing the fine.
Right. There's one other issue that I've noted in here is that we have a maximum fine and then we have minimum fines based on first, second, third convictions. But there doesn't appear to be flexibility for the judge with the minimum fines. And I guess my only question is, what do we do? What's done if an individual is clearly indigent? Does the judge have any discretion, or should they have any discretion with respect to those fines at that point? So lay that on the table.
I'm certainly more than open to the learned counsel's opinions of how best to implement that, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, Senator Metzger. Senator Domingo.
Thank you for bringing the bill, Senator Metzger. I have come across situations where an adult has taken children out on a fishing trip, for example, and you know, two young kids, 4 and 6 years old, and he decides, gee, won't it be nice to get a six-pack and take with me on this venture. And it led to disastrous consequences. And I am generally opposed to ratcheting up penalties to solve all of society's problems, but I got to say, I have no sympathy for people that exercise that degree of irresponsibility. I am a little bit concerned to the extent this might apply to the 19-year-old that's out with a 17-year-old, because I think that is a different nature of problem, and that isn't the focus of this bill, even though it might catch it. And so I would be interested in exploring things that will really focus on the adult really abusing their position of authority and taking alcohol and becoming involved in a very irresponsible situation. I appreciate you bringing the bill.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, concerns, comments, political statements, or otherwise? Blathering on and on. There are none. Thank you very much.
It's Monday. We're allowed to blather.
Yes, exactly. Kelly Skye.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye. I'm a legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose this bill for a number of reasons, one of which is not that we don't like the concept. I think that everybody can agree that driving under the influence of intoxicants with a minor in the car is a bad idea, and we couldn't sit here and say that we oppose enhancing penalties, but we don't believe that this is a good vehicle in which to do so. I've summarized a number of my arguments in my written testimony, the first of which is that this conduct is already punishable under the recklessly endangering statute, and frequently in Multnomah County we see this as an additional charge on any DUI case where there was a child in the car. The prosecutor will add a charge of recklessly endangering another. And in order to convict a person on that count, all the state needs to do is prove, is to convince the jury or the judge, if they're the fact finder in that situation, that the conduct was reckless and that it created a substantial risk of injury to the child. The reckless state of mind is commonly applied in these drunk driving situations. As you know, homicides that occur in drunk driving where the driver's under the influence are all prosecuted under a reckless state of mind. So this conduct is commonly already prosecuted under the recklessly endangering. The problem with trying to put this provision into the reckless endangering statute is a couple. One, you risk watering down the reckless endangering statute. If you draw this bright line that driving under the influence of intoxicants with a person under the age of 18 as a passenger in your car, then you are making a legislative indication of this is the bright line, this is where we're going to draw the line as to what we deem to be reckless conduct as a matter of law. So that the person who comes in and they've got, it's the mother and they've got their 25-year-old son in the car,
the prosecutor's hands are going to be a little bit tied in charging that person with recklessly endangering another because the statute actually draws the line at 18. Right now, the prosecutor can charge or the police officer can arrest for any age of individual in the car. And as I said, they frequently do. It can be someone that's your same age. You're 40 years old as the driver and you've got a 40-year-old passenger. If you're drunk and you're driving, you're recklessly endangering that person's safety, and it's already prosecutable. The other problem is that Mr. Prinz indicated, and that is the culpable mental state. Oregon law requires a culpable mental state for all crimes unless there is a clear legislative indication that they do not want to require that culpable mental state. And I read a number of the cases that the court has analyzed this. DUI is one that has been deemed to be a strict liability statute. You're drunk, you're driving, or you're under the influence, you're driving, you're guilty. There is, you don't have to know that you're drunk, you don't have to be acting in a reckless manner, or you don't have to be intentionally drunk. You just are guilty if you're doing these things. This legislation is attempting to create a strict liability crime like that. You drive under the influence, you have a passenger who's under the 18, you are guilty. Where that becomes a problem is you're putting it into a reckless statute, a statute that requires a reckless state of mind. So it's the court is going to look at this, and they are going to try to determine whether the legislature gave a clear indication that they didn't want this to be required. And the fact that it's in a reckless statute is going to be the problem. It's going to create confusion, litigation, most certainly, and I gave two examples in my written testimony. One is DUI, and the court looked at that and determined that strict liability. The most recent case in this area is a Portland City Code, possession of a loaded firearm in the city. And in that statute, it did not provide a culpable mental state, and the court said, after looking at it, that because it's a crime, we are going to require a culpable mental state, and we're going to require that the state prove that the person knew they possessed the weapon and that they knew it was loaded. So they wrote it, or they basically interpreted into the statute that mental state, and that's what will happen with this legislation. I suggested, and it was suggested by Mr. Prinz, that perhaps a more appropriate place to put this is in the DUI statute as a sentence enhancement, because that is already a strict liability crime, so you won't run up with this confusion. It could be a sentence enhancer, or it could change the level of the crime. It would be up to you how you wanted to do that, but that would be a safer place to put this than within the reckless endangering statute. I just testified in House Transportation on a bill with a similar problem, and that was to put some specific provisions in the reckless driving statute. Driving a certain amount over the speed limit creates reckless driving. And it's the same problem. They wanted to create a strict liability crime by putting it into the reckless driving statute. And the Oregon State Police testified in opposition to that because they agreed that this would water down the reckless driving statute, that it would suggest that if you're not doing this exact conduct that we've outlined in the statute, that perhaps you're not acting recklessly. And my final argument is that once the legislature undertakes the process of defining what conduct is reckless as a matter of law, then you are basically opening the floodgates to other people to come in and say, well, we think that this conduct should be reckless as a matter of law. You could have the schools coming in and saying, speeding through a school zone is recklessly endangering another. We want you to pass a bill that says that. And you can see how your recklessly endangering another person statute could become a long list of conduct which eventually would be viewed as exclusive. That if it wasn't in the list, then it's not reckless. This statute is broad. It allows a prosecutor or a police officer to charge anything that they believe to be reckless that endangers another person. And it should stay that way.
Kelly, I understand to a degree what you're saying, but the original statute isn't changed because the word is or, and then it goes on with the new construct. So, I mean, I tend to agree with you. It probably should be, or if your council ought to be in the DRI statutes, or I think that would be a lot clearer. But I mean, even in this construct, I don't see that it diminishes its impact because the original language is still there.
Right. The original, Chairman, the original language is still there, but then you're providing another way of proving it. It's basically an alternative theory, which does not require a culpable.
I don't think it's an alternative theory at all. You've got first a person commits the crime of recklessly endangering another person if, then A, the person recklessly engages in conduct which creates a substantial risk of serious physical injury or to another person. Then it says or. So that's a standalone provision.
I'm sorry.
That's a standalone provision. That's not connected to the subsequent new language. It's an or. Either that or this. Correct?
Correct.
So I don't understand
whether
how you're saying that somehow diminishes.
Chairman, what they are two different ways that...
Exactly, two different ways.
Well, the or, I think, I agree with you. It creates two different ways to prove the same crime. But the crime itself is recklessly endangering another, and recklessly is sort of a legal term of art because it's defined in the criminal code.
Right. And again, I'm not going to argue the point too much. Mm-hmm. I think we could clarify the language even here if we chose to. But I agree with the counsel. It probably should be in the DUI statute. So.
And, Chairman, if I did want to draw your attention, there is a House bill out there that attempts to address this same issue, and that is House Bill 2266, which perhaps is a better way to do it. What that does is, at the very least, makes a person who drives with a person under the age of 18 ineligible for diversion. So that's an enhanced penalty on a DUI, and that's another way of looking at it. And the other concern that I did want to raise that I believe Senator Ringo raised earlier is that there is no requirement in this bill that the driver themselves be over the age of 18. So it really doesn't focus on adults. And I would like to remind the committee that DUIs are juveniles are prosecuted as adults on traffic offenses in general. There's a blanket waiver. And so if you do have your person who's 17 years old and they're driving with a person who's 13 months younger than them, this is going to apply to them. It's not just adults. And so, and again, traffic offenses are not expungible. So it's a severe punishment for someone who's young.
So, Kelly, in what form would your organization support this kind of a concept?
Well, I can't say that OCDLA is going to come out and support a bill, but we would not object to a bill that placed this into the DUI statute, perhaps as an enhancement. You could put the fines that are in 348, you could put a fine schedule similar to that into the DUI bill. There are a number of things that have been done with DUIs lately. They've increased the penalties for subsequent offenses. There are a number of things along those lines that you could do.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? None. Any other persons wishing to testify on Senate Bill 348? There are none. We're going to take the comments under advisement. Work on this thing, and we'll be back. Sure. Mm-hmm.